From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The race for the American presidency is like Olympic hurdling. You have to run full tilt and jump over barriers, in this case state primaries, to take the day. Mitt Romney got the gold yesterday in Michigan, and the Democrats headed off to a debate in Nevada, where warring Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton hugged it out. For more, we've got NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So this is when it gets fun. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have been tense around race. And the first question the moderator lobbed at Hillary Clinton concerned BET founder Bob Johnson's negative comments about Barack Obama. So how'd she handle her response?
She went straight into the truce mode that we had been seeing beginning late the night before when, after seeing a remark from Obama, Hillary Clinton took her opportunity to say, okay, let's all climb down a little bit. And the truce seemed to have held pretty well through Tuesday. And when we got to the debate, the big question is, you know these guys are going to ask them, how are they going to handle it? And Hillary immediately went into the look, we're all family here. And I was almost waiting there for a second for I to hear a little soundtrack come up of Sister Sledge singing, we are family from back in the day. I mean, it would have been appropriate at that
point. Or maybe Ebony and Ivory.
Well, yeah, Paul McCartney. We could have brought a lot of the old timers back. But that was clearly going to be the mode of the evening. It was going to be the mood. I'm not so sure that we've seen the end of this conflict. I'm not so sure that some of the surrogates who were being blamed for all this are really so independent from the principles. I'm not so certain that it can all be just put in a little box and shoved under the bed for the next several months. We'll see.
Now, Senator Clinton seemed to change her style a little bit in this debate. She went for the Bush administration. There's this whole question of the circular firing squad, whether Democrats should just sort of play down their differences. Is she trying to get out of that mode?
I think that she saw immediately after this thing began about a week or so ago that whatever its long-term effect and whatever its overall effect, it was having a specifically damaging effect for her campaign with respect to a key constituency in the Democratic Party with whom she had previously been the leading candidate, and that's African Americans. This would be the worst possible time for her to sour her relationship with African Americans, not only because it was Martin Luther King's birthday yesterday, but also because we're going into the first primaries where minorities really have a substantial chunk of the vote. South Carolina is coming up.
Let me ask you about the Republicans. This was a situation where there were more Republican candidates than Democrats for Michigan because of the whole party kerfuffle. Now, they're actually open primaries, meaning that anyone can vote for either party. Some folks said John McCain was going to benefit, but Mitt Romney took the day. Why?
Because in Michigan yesterday, as opposed to 8 years ago when John McCain won in Michigan, the independent vote did not come out for John McCain. The independent vote and the Democratic vote, I should add, because back in 2000, only about half the people voting on the Republican side between John McCain and George W. Bush were actually Republicans. The rest of them were independents and Democrats. Democrats didn't have a contest in 2000 at the time they got to Michigan, so a lot of them went across the aisle to express their preference for John McCain and their lack of preference for George Bush. Yesterday, while there was not a truly meaningful Democratic contest, only Hillary Clinton among the major contenders had her name on the ballot, even so, there was a Democratic contest, and a lot of the campaigns were urging people to either vote for Hillary or vote for uncommitted. So there was a reason for Democrats to go the other way. Plus, turnout was lousy. The weather was very bad, and turnout was just not what it was in the past.
When you look at the Republican field, is this really a situation where Mitt Romney had to save his bacon, and he did so?
You would have to say that after putting all of his marbles on Iowa and New Hampshire and finishing second in those two places, he really needed to win in this, his native state. And he clearly ran the campaign as though he knew that and wanted people to think that. I think he always felt pretty confident about Michigan, and so he figured, let's get everybody to look at this as my make-or-break state, and then when I win it, and he did in the end by 9 percentage points, then people will say, wow, Mitt made it. Mitt didn't get broken there. He's back. He's really in the hunt, and I think that's true.
Well, Ron, always great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Farai.
We've been speaking with NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now, the economy was a key issue for Mitt Romney as he campaigned in Michigan this week. With 39% of the vote and a big victory, Romney's message seemed to resonate with voters. To continue our conversation about the Michigan primary, we have Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. Welcome.
Thank you, Farrah. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm really glad you're coming back on the show. And first off, this was such a strange primary.
Yes.
But what's your reaction to the results?
Well, I mean, it's what I expected. I figured that Mitt Romney would win. He had a tough fight here. He started off ahead, and Senator McCain went ahead of him on the Republican side, and then he pulled out a victory last night. And I thought he would. I mean, it's too much. Too many roots that he has here in Michigan. So I figured he'd pull it out at the end. But on the Democratic side, you know, we really had Hillary Clinton versus uncommitted. And, you know, the Obama campaign and as well as the Edwards campaign were really pushing this uncommitted vote. But I figured it wouldn't get over the hump. Although it won, 70% of African Americans voted for the uncommitted slot, which was big here. That's a heck of a statement.
Right.
And if Senator Clinton is to be the nominee, she's going to repair the relationships here with our community, particularly here in the city of Detroit.
You know, what you mentioned about the questions of uncommitted is really what we talked about yesterday with the news director for WDET right in Detroit, Jerome Vaughn.
Yep.
Yesterday, let's listen to what he had to say.
The voters here are really pretty mad. African Americans feel disenfranchised. They feel like they don't have the opportunity to vote for Barack Obama or John Edwards, and so they feel cheated, and they're looking for solutions. They want Michigan to do better. They want the auto industry to do better. They want Detroit to do better.
Now, Mayor, you are in Detroit. It's a city with so much historic culture, so much of a place in American history. Are your constituents depressed, beaten down, hopeful? What's going on emotionally?
Well, a certain segment of our community, you know, of course, is frustrated because you've had 30,000 jobs lost in our community in over the past 5 years. And so you have people in the midst of a transitioning economy. I mean, our grandparents came to Detroit because Henry Ford was hiring. And so generations of people grew up here working in the auto plants. And so that is gone, and it's never coming back the way it once was. And so there's a center of frustration, but there's also a great hope. I mean, even in the midst of this decline, the state is in a billion-dollar deficit. The city of Detroit is balanced. I mean, we've built 7 hotels in the last 5 years. We've opened up 75 new businesses downtown. We're doing a $2 billion development on the river. So people starting to feel that Detroit can come back. So you have certain amounts of hope. But where there is a real, real strong, tenacious, and aggressive feeling of hopelessness is in a partnership with the federal government. And people want the next president to understand in Michigan, and I hear this a lot here, Michigan saved this country in World War II. We built warheads here. We transitioned our auto plants to be able to build weapons to go fight. So we won the war. And now we want the country to focus on helping Michigan to come back. And so people feel that we've been totally separated and dissed, if you will, by the federal government. We want the opportunity to have a voice in the choice for the next president. And so that frustration is continuing to grow here as our primary passed us and the Democratic Party failed us nationally.
You're a Democrat. Your
Yes.
mother is a Democrat. She heads the Congressional Black Caucus right now, a huge position. And do you believe, given what you call the very least a misstep by your party in Michigan, that the Democratic Party will do better in the White House than the Republicans?
You know, I instead of doing it by party, I just believe that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are better candidates than anybody on the other side. And I feel very comfortable saying that. I think that on its face, Hillary Clinton is probably the smartest person running. I really believe that. And what Barack Obama has done to inspire a generation, I believe, you know, of people to wake up and believe in the body politic, it's something that's phenomenal for this country. We do need inspirational leadership. We shouldn't chagrin that. Like, it's something that we don't need, especially in a place where we've been demoralized. So in several states across the country and how we're perceived around the world, I believe there'd be much, you know, we're spending $600 billion in a war, And the total HUD budget is $40 billion. And so mayors across the country, whether you're in Detroit or Dallas or Philadelphia or Chicago, are saying, where's the focus on us, the COPS program, to put additional police officers on the street? We have to start to talk about the domestic issues that shape America.
When you say that you want more of a partnership with the federal government, what does that really mean to you? I mean, are you talking schools? Are you talking jobs programs? Be as specific as you can. If you had your dream situation with the White House and the Congress, what would Detroit get out of that?
First, in that level of specificity, the partnership has to detail what's best for that city. And I'll go, that's a broad statement. I mean that what's good for Little Rock may not be the same thing that's good for Detroit. What's good for L.A. may not need be the same thing. Everybody wants better schools. Everybody wants those type of things. But what Detroit needs are workforce reinvestment dollars. You know, in the Carter administration, we received exponentially more money than we're receiving now, and a much more important transformation in our workforce because of globalization. I need money to take a person who's been on the line at Ford or Chrysler or GM for 15 years, money and resources and programs, and take that person and move them to an emerging field, healthcare, service. How do we retrain someone who's done the same thing for 10 or 15 years into a new field? And where does the federal government? The city is stepping up with dollars. Even the state is stepping up with dollars. We need the federal government because we're all American citizens.
Well, Mayor Kilpatrick, thank you so much for coming on again.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate you, Fry.
Thanks. We have been speaking with Kwame Kilpatrick, the mayor of Detroit, Michigan. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're talking about Mitt Romney's win in Michigan and the racial smackdown between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's campaigns. For more on that, we've got the issue of money as well. Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators, is with us. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. We've also got Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She is a political scientist and African-American studies professor at Princeton University. Hey, folks.
Hi.
Hi, Farai.
Wow, a lot to talk about. Well, we're going to go back to the race baiting. This is the week where race went from the subtext to supertext, and our web producer Jeff Bennett did a wonderful timeline on the blog about who said when, and including when Hillary Clinton seemed to kick things off with remarks about Martin Luther King Jr. and whether or not the presidency was really what made the civil rights movement work. So, Ron, if this is a case of foot and mouth disease, does Clinton have no one on her campaign who could have blocked it?
You would think. I mean, for goodness sakes, you're talking about a woman whose husband is the self-proclaimed first African-American president in the United States. She made a sort of tongue-in-cheek joke this past August where she said that she was in an interracial marriage. You would think that Senator Clinton, who's vying for the top spot in the nation, given her history and given her family history, she'd have somebody on her staff who would say, Senator Clinton, this is not the road you want to go down, particularly given the demographics coming up in states such as South Carolina and Nevada. For goodness sakes, to try to get a row on a racial issue with Senator Obama in some of these key states, I think, is a crucial and critical mistake that she made. And as you saw last night in the debate, she's trying to recover from that.
Melissa, you had a situation where Donna Brazile, who's one of our contributors and now a political analyst, ran Al Gore's campaign. But is there anyone black on the inner circle in these campaigns now on the Democratic side or Republican side?
There are African-Americans on the inner circle of all three of the front-running Democratic campaigns, Edwards, Obama, and Clinton. But I think we have to be a little bit careful about this sort of clear analysis that it was definitely bad to do this racial work, and I mean bad from an electoral perspective. One of the things that we know about American politics is that what you want to do is plant ideas. Voters tend to not remember the content of all the reasons that they do or don't like a candidate. They remember sort of a summary conclusion, so they kind of do pluses and minuses. And part of what the Clinton campaign was up to here was simply reminding American voters or encouraging American voters to think about Barack Obama as black. over and over again in the public opinion polls, we've seen both white and African-American voters saying he represents a bunch of things, but not necessarily sort of the black candidate. So as nutty as all of this appeared to be, it is not necessarily a bad electoral strategy to remind Americans who have notoriously been very poor at voting for African-Americans in majority white districts, which is what the U.S. National District is. It's not necessarily a bad strategy, if you want to win, to remind people that Barack Obama's black.
So let me make sure I'm getting this straight. You're basically saying that although the Clinton campaign has been reaching out to African-Americans, it is, and I want to make sure I'm getting this correct, in some way trying to remind racially insensitive American voters that Barack Obama is black? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not just racially insensitive voters. I mean, let me be clear here, because this is not about naked racism, like, oh, Americans just go out and can't bring themselves to vote for a black guy. There's some of that, but those folks weren't going to vote for Barack Obama anyway, right? They already noticed, and they weren't going to vote for him. No, it has more to do with our conceptions of what is a president, what do we expect, and what is sort of a black leader. And so part of what this was about, I believe, was sort of trying to paint Barack Obama as, you know, a black leader, a fine, good human being, but someone who is reasonably compartmentalized in one segment of American politics, rather than broadly representative of the whole population. Now, I should say that I am a political analyst and political scientist. I'm also an Obama supporter, so I'm sure I have my own biases here. But it is one way to read what happened here, is that it is sort of a way of reminding people. The way that, for example, juries are reminded, you know, you kind of get something out of your mouth, even if the judge comes back and says, no, no, you're not to consider that. Once the jury has heard it, it's hard for them to get it out of their heads.
Ron, let me have you jump in here. And when you think about this positioning, where does Edwards fall in this?
Well, Senator Edwards, I think, took the right tone where he said that the Democratic Party candidates should be unified in talking about the issues that are important to their constituency and why it was important to elect a Democrat as the next president of the United States. I think he's smart. I mean, the last thing, if I were Senator Edwards, I would want to do is inject myself, particularly on such a sensitive issue as race or the perception of an African-American candidate. Is he viable? Is he a realistic candidate for president? Edwards was smart to stay out of that. But I tell you, I would like to be one who said that this is a coincidence that we've seen from the Clinton campaign, that they did not mean to inject racism so overtly. But I have to tell you, as an observer of this and as a political analyst watching former Governor Shaheen's husband talk about Senator Obama, watching BET founder Bob Johnson this past weekend talking about Obama and making allegorical references to his drug use, I would think that the Clintons are better than this. I would think that the Clintons are better than trying to do whatever it takes to gain elective office and using race as a criterion. I think it's wrong. Senator Obama is an inspiration on his own. I think he's a fantastic senator by the way that he goes about delivering a message as a fantastic candidate. Race just does not need to be so overt, and I think that was a mistake that the Clintons made that they'll pay for later.
All right, guys, we are going to have to keep this extremely tight, but I want to take a quick tour of the money issue. Now, the fundraising numbers for candidates came out yesterday. Rudy Giuliani asked his senior staff to forego their paychecks for January. John McCain is asking for a $3 million loan. Ron, is there going to be some problems with the cash flow, either on the Republican or Democratic sides?
I'll stick to my side, and I'll let the professor talk about the Democrats. I think that the Republican candidates have hit somewhat of a wall. They've hit a lot of the people that they're seeking campaign contributions from, and then the voters wanted to see how they were doing. Senator McCain, by his own admission, has had money gushing in since his victory in New Hampshire. I guarantee you Governor Romney, after his victory yesterday in Michigan, will find the same. What I'm looking at, Farai, is the candidates such as Mayor Giuliani, Senator Fred Thompson, those who aren't necessarily at the top of the pack. Will they have enough money to compete after Super Tuesday? And I think the answer to that is no.
All right, Melissa, what about the Democrats?
Well, again, this is sort of, you know, the key in why these early primary and early caucus states matter. It's not just the win, it's not just the momentum, and it's not just the delegates. It has a great deal to do with how a win encourages, or even a close second, can encourage huge fundraising drives to take off. These candidates on the Democratic side, Barack and Hillary, are making nearly $1 million a day since the new year. Edwards is clearly starting to run out of money, which is going to be part of how it's going to make it very difficult for him to go past South Carolina and Nevada in this campaign. So the top two frontrunners are getting an enormous amount of money at this point. And as long as they keep trading victories back and forth between each other, they're going to keep bringing the money in.
All right, Melissa and Ron, we'll catch up with you more later.
Take care, Farai. Bye, Melissa.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. He joined me from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And we also heard from Melissa Harris Lacewell. She is a political science and African American studies professor at Princeton University. And she joined us from Princeton. We've heard about race, local economics, campaign money, but how are Black gays and lesbians thinking about the election? We have two voices from opposite sides of the political spectrum. Jasmine Kanick is an activist and journalist and a liberal voice you hear regularly on our show. And Abner Mason is the executive director of AIDS Responsibility. He's also a former president of the gay and lesbian advocacy group, the National Log Cabin Republicans. Welcome, guys.
Thanks. Hello, thanks.
So, Abner, let me start with you. There's, I'm remembering a sketch on The Daily Show where basically Stephen Colbert runs around gathering up all the constituents for the Democratic Party, and there's like one lesbian, one gay guy, one Black guy, one South Asian. There's kind of a joke about how the Democrats have all these different constituencies, but so do Republicans. And how did you get involved as a gay Black man with the Republican Party?
I think like a lot of gay Republicans, I tend to be more fiscally conservative, socially more moderate to liberal. And so that is the sort of formula that I think defines, the political formula that defines most gay and lesbian Republicans. And I also worked in government for quite a while in Massachusetts. I was chief policy advisor for the previous two governors, both of whom were Republican, Governor Paul Cellucci and Governor Swift. So I was politically involved in terms of philosophy, but I also worked in Republican administration.
How did your leadership of the Log Cabin Republicans add race into the mix there? Because I'm assuming that the organization is mostly white.
It is. I think Republicans... tried, we don't always achieve it, but try to view race as not a defining issue and to treat people equally regardless of their race or gender. So from my perspective, when I was president of Log Cabin, people chose me because I thought I'd do a good job, and hopefully I did. I think they were pleased to have some diversity in the leadership, but it certainly was not a situation where people said, oh, we need someone Black, so we'll pick Abner.
Jasmine, let me turn to you. So when you think about your role in the universe where you have a blog, you do political advocacy, you do a lot of different things, where do you fit in terms of raising specifically gay and lesbian issues and then also translating them to the Black community and to other communities?
You know, I sort of look at my role as just that of, you know, being an African-American female who is also lesbian. So, you know, I'm dealing with all of the issues that, you know, we deal with as Blacks, issues we deal with as gays and lesbians, as well as just being female. So when I look at the work that I do, I'm always very conscious to make sure that, you know, especially sort of in the gay and lesbian political arena, which oftentimes is very colorless, that, you know, we have a voice and that we're represented. And that's very, very important to me. And at the same time, in the African-American community, it's very important that it's known that we're not all homophobic and that we're not all heterosexual and that we are and have always been an important part of the community. So it's kind of blending the two together. And race, you know, becomes an issue oftentimes within the gay and lesbian community as well as homophobia in the African-American community.
Abner was just saying that being fiscally conservative is one of the issues that he thinks unites Black gay Republicans. Is there such a thing for liberals or Democrats?
We have a lot of issues that unite us. I think one misconception that has been out there a long time, especially as it relates to gay politics, is that all gays are only concerned with gay marriage. And I have to be the first one to tell you that as an African American, that's probably the last thing on my list if it's on my list. I'm trying to pay the rent, put food on my table, and keep a roof over my head. As many, not only African American gays and lesbians, but Latino and Asian who, you know, we oftentimes don't live that life you see on the L Word or in Queer as Folk. We don't live in West Hollywood. You know, we live in West Adams and we live in Leimert Park and we live where other Blacks and Latinos tend to live. And I think that, you know, is probably one of the more defining issues that unites us in terms of the economy and economics and being able to take care of each other. I know that healthcare is a huge issue for all of us right now. Being able to, again, put food on our table and have a job to go to.
Abner, is there room to reach across the aisle, not based on sexuality, but to gay and lesbian Democrats?
To reach across the aisle in the sense of...
Across political parties.
In the sense of trying to get to accomplish things that are good for the country?
Well, yeah, and trying to push a legislative agenda around whatever it is, around health care. I mean, could there be a coalition, the log cabin Republicans reaching out to some...
The Stonewall Democrat.
There you go.
Well, I think there are... definitely opportunities for common ground, and you know, we have to find those. It's not always easy because we live in such a polarized political environment. But if we're going to accomplish good things for our country that we all love and we all want, this America to be better tomorrow than it is today, we want to solve problems, I absolutely think it's going to be critical that we find ways to work together, and that's going to require some mutual respect and a real search for common ground. But it's not easy in the current environment.
Jasmine, you're putting together a forum in Los Angeles dealing with African-American gays and lesbians and political agendas. You reached out to the candidates. Did any of them respond? Do you feel like the candidates even have this on the radar?
No, I don't feel like they have it on the radar. I've heard from Obama's camp. I've heard from Hillary's camp. We did reach out to both the leading Democratic and Republican candidates. I think the forum for me and for a lot of people is particularly important because when you think again of gay and lesbian politics, you'd never think of sort of the subgroups that come into that, African Americans, Latinos, and Asians. And if the candidates and the people who are, you know, do their strategic planning, you know, put all of that together, there could really be some quote-unquote audacity and some change out there. I mean, when I think of last year, and I'm sure you'll remember this, Farai, when, you know, Obama, you know, went to South Carolina and had Donnie McClurkin, there was an uproar over that. But, and this, again, was an event to reach out to African-American constituents
Just to put it out there, he's the singer and pastor who has criticized homosexuality.
Was once gay and now has turned openly homophobic towards all gays and lesbians. So, instead of, you know, maybe reaching out to the African-American gay and lesbian community, Obama's, you know, camp went and found a white gay pastor and put him in front of this Southern Black audience. And those are the kind of things that I hope not to see happen again. And one of the ways that can happen is by us having a conversation.
All right. Well, Jasmine and Abner, thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
Jasmine Kanick is an activist, blogger, and liberal voice you hear regularly on the show. She joined me here in the studios of NPR West. And Abner Mason is executive director of AIDS Responsibility. He's also a former president of the Log Cabin Republicans. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. You have been lighting up our blog, News and Views, with reaction to this week's political headlines. Jeffrey Bennett is our show's web producer and your guide to the blogosphere. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So, Election 08 is always a hot topic on News and Views. Right. What are people talking about this week?
Well, this week our readers had a lot to say about the issue of race being injected into the presidential campaign. Clinton and Obama have since called a truce. But at the height of their back and forth, here's what a few people had to say on our blog. Christopher Morrison wrote, "The Clinton people began to get nervous about winning, so they picked up this issue of race because they thought it would work. A person named Jeff wrote, "The dispute between the two campaigns is nothing more than the core of the Democratic Party displaying the dysfunction of their identity politics." And Tracy wrote, "Black people need to stop being so sensitive. Not every statement made is a personal attack." It's just a sampling of what people had to say.
Oh, yeah. And Ron Paul on the GOP side, comment got people talking. What's that?
Yeah, whenever we post about Ron Paul, it's always the top post of the week. I think his supporters are really have an impressive presence online. But here's the issue. The New Republic magazine discovered racist and homophobic rants and newsletters attributed to Ron Paul that were released in the 80s and 90s. Now, his campaign manager has since said the candidate assumes moral responsibility, though he says he didn't read or approve the material before it was published. So on our blog, Joseph Papandry wrote, "You mean to tell me you didn't see the letter for almost 20 years and your name was used for the newsletter? What does that say about your leadership style about Ron Paul?" And Stephen Bradford said it was nothing but a blatant smear campaign that's being brought against a man who obviously strikes fear into some people.
Well, look, this is an interesting one. Entertainers and steroids. Isn't that supposed to be something that athletes do? What's going on there?
Apparently, but the thinking is that these celebrities are taking these steroids for their anti-aging purposes. Mary J. Blige, 50 Cent, Timbaland, Wyclef Jean, and Tyler Perry were named in a performance-enhancing drug probe by a New York State district attorney. Now, the authorities say they have uncovered no evidence that these celebrities violated any drug laws, and Mary J. Blige released a statement saying that she was in no way involved. But on our blog, someone using the alias Hater posted, "So that's how Mary stays looking so young." And a reader named Jay wrote in to say he's not believing the hype, and he says it's a distraction to keep people from focusing on the war. Now, I don't know about that, but we'll keep an eye on this story regardless. And the other big entertainment story this week was Oprah Winfrey getting her own TV network called, appropriately enough, OWN.
We also have some big news here in the show. We are going to South Carolina for the primary. We're going to be broadcasting from South Carolina. Some folks are calling this the Black primary.
Yeah.
And we want to hear from you if you live in South Carolina. How can folks in the state get in touch with us?
We put a post on our blog about that. So anybody who lives in South Carolina, anyone who's going to South Carolina to cover the primary there can get in touch with us, and we might even have them on the show.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. And now on to our Bloggers Roundtable. We've got more politics, plus Angelina Jolie gets nominated for an NAACP Image Award, and New Jersey apologizes for slavery. With us this week, Carmen Van Kerkhove. She is the co-founder and president of New Demographic, an anti-racism training company. She blogs at racialicious.com. Also, Shay Riley of the blog Booker Rising, and Bomani Jones. He teaches at Duke University and blogs at bomanijones.com. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks.
Hello. Hello.
So we have been talking about the presidential race, and during last night's debate in Las Vegas, Hillary Clinton declared a truce.
Senator Obama and I agree completely that, you know, neither race nor gender should be a part of this campaign.
Shay, you've been blogging about the issue. What are people saying?
Well, it's very interesting because most of my liberal and moderate bloggers support Obama, and I even have some moderate conservative readers of my blog who are supporting Obama. Of course, my Republican readers are supporting the Republican candidates. And what people are saying is that they believe that this was intentional on behalf of the Clinton campaign in order to tag Obama as, you know, the Black candidate, because up till now he's been, you know, promoting himself as, you know, an American politician trying to bridge together different groups of people who happens to be Black as opposed to the Black candidate. And so a lot of my readers feel that this was purposefully done, you know, just an array of things, whether the spade work comments or the fairy tale comments or just, you know, other things that are seen as racially coded language.
Fairy tale comment coming from Bill Clinton.
Yes, in order to, you know, tag Obama with this label, and even using Black surrogates to do so. So people have been very upset with that on my blog.
I'm going to go to you, Bomani. There's also a question. Some bloggers are saying that all the talk about race, as important as it might be, is a distraction from the fact that a lot of candidates have not laid down a firm agenda for America, that there's a question of, well, what are you really going to do for us? How do you feel about that?
Well, I thought that was the larger point that Hillary Clinton, that could have been made about Obama with the statement that Lyndon Johnson pushed through those initiatives, not Martin Luther King. There's a question about Obama with his track record, whether he has the experience necessary to push through an agenda at all, let alone what agenda that he can come up with. If race injected as an issue has been a distraction, I'm somewhat stunned because maybe I have a bit of an old school mentality, but it's kind of hard to avoid that Obama is black thing, no matter how much people, you know, put it out there or pull it back. But I thought Clinton had a point that the reason the civil rights legislation was pushed through as it was because Lyndon Johnson was the most incredibly connected politician of his time. The agenda becomes very important, and I think we have lost sight of that a bit.
Now, Carmen, you are someone who looks at how people react to race in the workplace. What about this debate in terms of, I mean, let me make a distinction. There are a lot of us who are news addicts, including a lot of bloggers. And then there are some people who are just like, oh my gosh, can you turn off the TV? Can you turn off the radio? Can you click off the blog? Do you think that the issue of race as it's playing out is going to turn some people off?
I think that's always a possibility, but what to me is most unfortunate about how all the back and forth about race has developed is that it really seems to go against the spirit of Obama's approach to race. While the rest of the political machine seems to be stuck in this 1960s mindset, to me, as a multiracial Asian American woman, what I find most refreshing about Obama is that he really gets how race in America is lived in 2008. You know, everyone else is still pushing this binary model that pretends like there are only two battling forces. You know, you're either black or white, you're either a victim or an oppressor. But Obama, you know, in his speech this weekend, I was really moved when he talked about a grassroots movement of people of all colors, black, white, Hispanic, and Asian. And to me, that really reflects that he gets how race is lived in 2008.
Shay, there's also, as the candidates move on to Nevada, Barack Obama has been using the phrase, yes, we can, which in Spanish is si se puede. And is there, among other things, you know, a linguistic attempt to make this bridge to a multiracial America? If so, is it working?
I think it can work. I mean, with the limited amount of Spanish that I know, I was thinking si se puede, too, and, you know, and hoping that he would use that. I would use that if I were him in Nevada. And, you know, and that just shows that he's trying, you know, he's been running on this theme of change and transcendence, and that's part of his effort to bridge these different groups of people. But what's interesting is that a Rasmussen poll recently showed that there's this growing divide, if you will, among Democrats racially in terms of whom they're supporting, with an overwhelming majority of white Democrats supporting Clinton and an overwhelming majority of black Democrats now supporting Obama. It will be interesting to see how the Latino vote goes, but I think it will go for Clinton personally. So as an independent observer, I'm still deciding whether I'll even vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary. I'm not sure which one yet. It's just interesting to see how this is all shaking out racially as, you know, the candidates try to promote change and bring the different groups together. But there seems to be more of a racial divide.
Bomani, earlier in the show, we spoke with Kwame Kilpatrick, the mayor of Detroit, and he was saying that what he wants to see from any candidate is really a focus on urban issues and how the federal government can interface better with cities. Is there space in the debates right now for talking about issues that are specific, that may not be specifically, for example, black issues, but because of the urbanization of the black community heavily affect African Americans? Is there a way to really focus in on specific issues, urban issues, education, all that, in the middle of these other debates?
Well, it could very easily be done if someone simply broached the topic. It's not hard to create any topic of conversation in a debate or anything else. All someone has to do is bring it up and bring it up in a way that makes it compelling to a broad number of people. The problem, I think, as things stand now, is that black people are so marginalized as a voting bloc and considered to be so dedicated to the Democratic cause. And in this case, I think there's a general assumption that the black population will follow behind Obama just because, I mean, he's black. You know, that's how the assumption will be that it will go that way. I think I would like to see more of a discussion of urban issues, and I certainly think there's room. I just don't think it will come up because if you really, you know, look at the studies on who votes when and why, you're not going to see that come up in this election because the votes that these people are trying to curry as of right now really aren't that concerned with urban issues.
I want to take a quick tour of the entertainment world. Angelina Jolie recently nominated for Outstanding Actress by the NAACP Image Awards. This was for A Mighty Heart, where she wore what some people consider brown skin to play Marianne Pearl, the wife and widow of Daniel Pearl, the journalist who was slain. Now, Carmen, you've been blogging about this at Racialicious. What are people saying about whether or not it's weird for her to be nominated for this role?
A lot of people I know definitely think it's very weird. And, you know, I looked up on the NAACP site what the mission of the Image Awards is, and it says that it honors projects and individuals that promote diversity in the arts and television, recording, literature, and motion pictures. And I would imagine that that would mean diversity both in the images on the screen and also among the people involved in the arts. But I'm really not sure how casting a white actress to play an Afro-Cuban woman really helps diversity. I mean, I think it's really unfortunate. You know, there are so many great, talented young black actresses, Sophie Okonedo from Hotel Rwanda, for one, Kerry Washington from The Last King of Scotland, who I think would have been amazing in this role, but they were not allowed to really be able to make the most of this part because of Angelina Jolie. And I'm not sure that the NAACP is sending the right message by honoring that decision.
Bomani, is this a case in a positive way of kind of extending the world of blackness? There are a lot of people who aren't black who were nominated this year. America Ferrara, Jimmy Smits, people who did Dora the Explorer, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Is this just like the black big tent being unfurled over everyone else?
I mean, I can't make sense of it. I do remember very clearly a year that LL Cool J won the Image Award for Best Male Rap Artist and didn't even have a record out that year. Like, I mean, the Image Awards
but
and their nominees.
But his pecs were marvelous.
I'm sure they were, and I'm sure someone has said the same about Angelina Jolie somewhere around this. I can't figure this one out. This is much different than giving Bono a Lifetime Achievement Award for his work with African children. This, I've tried to make sense. I didn't know about it until, you know, I realized we would discuss it here, and I've yet to come up with one good reason for this. I was under the impression the Image Awards were about paying tribute to black performers who so often are ignored. The last thing Angelina Jolie is, was, or ever will be is ignored.
Shay, there's also been this whole issue of the Writers Guild, the NAACP was able to, you know, strike a pact, and then when you looked at the Golden Globes, they weren't able to strike a pact. I'm not sure, some numbers have shown that not that many people watch these award shows anyway, but are people keeping an eye in, you know, the blogosphere on this whole writer's strike and how it may affect the Oscars, may affect a lot of other things?
It doesn't seem to be, you know, a big issue among my readers, per se. We, you know, tend to focus more on political issues. But, you know, in getting back to the deal that WGA struck with the NAACP Image Awards, you know, it's a win-win situation for both of them because the NAACP's show can go on without having a, you know, strike outside its doors. And WGA, I'm assuming, won some concessions because it would not make for a good image to have mostly white, I presume, striking writers showing up at the NAACP Image Awards, either for the NAACP, which would be seen as, you know, opposing, you know, people who are trying to increase their salary, or for the striking workers who would be seen as opposing a civil rights group's activities. So it was a win-win situation.
Bomani, moving on again, New Jersey was the last northern state to free slaves. And last week, the state legislator apologized for slavery. Now, is this one of those things where, although very few states have apologized, it's okay to just say, we've got to just stop talking about this. We don't need any more states to apologize. Or is this a huge step forward?
Well, I would hope that the apologies for slavery would be followed by a real discussion of the true machination of slavery in this country. And I think that people have an unfortunate tendency to simply look at slavery through the lens of holding people captive and not just the total dehumanization that came from slavery. So the apology itself, I suppose, is cool. But I would hope that beyond that would be a little bit more of a deeper understanding of what the system was. I appreciate it. And I further think it's the impetus is on the state, since that was a state issue when it came up. The federal government did not ban it, but the states were the ones that worked hardest to protect or to shut it down. So it's greatly appreciated, I suppose, but it's just an incomplete step.
All right. Well, guys, I wish I had time to let you two chime in on that, but it has been a lot of fun. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Shay Riley of the blog Booker Rising. She was at member station WBEZ in Chicago. Also, Carmen Van Kerkhove, co-founder and president of New Demographic, an anti-racism training company. She blogs at racialicious.com. She was at our New York studios. And Bomani Jones of the blog BomaniJones.com. He was at the Duke University studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.